A national dialogue on mass shootings at schools, but sharp disagreement over what to do about it.
People sitting in my position did not take action. They didn't take proper action.
A redistricting map in a key midterm state could tip control of Congress.
And the result is going to be that the Democrats should easily pick up at least one seat and probably more than that.
And the Supreme Court takes another look at who has to pay union dues.
You know, this notion that they're speaking for me when they're not.
It's time to get caught up on what's happened and what's next. With Rachel Sutherland and John Decker, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington. There has been a lot of First Amendment expression this week about the Second Amendment. As has become all too frequent, there's a national dialogue going on about the proper way to respond to gun violence and school safety. President Trump, for his part, says this time will be different. He's promising action that will follow the talk.
People sitting in my position did not take action. They didn't take proper action. They took no action at all. We're going to take action.
That action should start, the president argues, with ending what he calls gun-free zones at schools. He's suggesting teachers and coaches with proper firearms training be allowed to carry weapons on campus and spring into action if required.
Gun-free zone to a maniac, because they're all cowards. A gun-free zone is let's go in and let's attack, because bullets aren't coming back at us. And if you do this, and a lot of people are talking about it, it's certainly a point that we'll discuss, but concealed carry for teachers and for people of talent, of that type of talent.
Arming teachers or other staff is also the position of the National Rifle Association. President Trump is also signaling support for expanded background checks, or at least closing gaps. That's something that he could find allies for in Congress. Legislation has been introduced in the House and Senate to do just that after the deadly church shooting in Sutherland Springs, Texas. Most of these suggestions have come at these listening sessions at the White House. President Trump has invited students and parents just days after their classmates and own children were murdered in their high school to offer ideas. It has provided raw emotion, sometimes squarely directed at President Trump.
I want to feel safe at school. You know, senior year and junior year, they were big years for me when I turned my academics around, started connecting with teachers, and I started actually enjoying school. And now, I don't know how I'm ever going to step foot on that place again. Or go to a public park after school, or be walking anywhere. Me and my friends, we get scared when a car drives by.
That's Samuel Zafe, a senior at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, pleading with his president face to face, asking why these events didn't stop after Columbine nearly 20 years ago. The president heard directly from Andrew Pollock, a parent whose daughter Meadow died at that Parkland school. His anger and frustration makes sense to any parent.
It doesn't make sense. Fix it. Should have been one school shooting, and we should have fixed it. And I'm pissed because my daughter I'm not going to see again.
As I said last week, finding solutions is not simple. These are difficult issues made harder by the forces of politics. The NRA, for instance, was quick to signal opposition to another proposal of President Trump's, raising the purchase age for rifles from 18 to 21. Congress ultimately would have to pass any federal law doing that. Teachers' organizations and school safety groups are also openly debating the merits of arming educators in classrooms or posting uniformed police at school entrances. These debates are happening across the country. Teenagers have staged walkouts, marching to state capitals, demanding answers from lawmakers they, in many cases, are still too young to vote for or against. Our White House correspondent, John Decker, has been following the school safety and gun debate that's been happening in the West Wing. So let's start there, John. President Trump has dived headfirst into this, even suggesting a proposal that so far does not have NRA approval.
And that proposal is one in which he suggested raising the age for purchasing a gun, maybe even just purchasing a semi-automatic weapon, from 18 to 21. And the NRA, the National Rifle Association, putting out a statement saying they are opposed to such a proposal. And interestingly enough, after the NRA put out that statement, the president backed away from his proposal, did not mention that proposal when he spoke to supporters at the CPAC conference on Friday, nor did he mention that proposal when asked about some legislative initiatives at a press conference later in the afternoon.
As you know very well, though, John, it's never just one issue at this White House. And I want to talk about something that's happened late this week with the Russia investigation with Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Thursday, we saw Paul Manafort, the former campaign chairman, and one of his business associates who also worked in the Trump campaign, Rick Gates, get a pretty heavy indictment. Both of them had already been facing charges. This new package, this new indictment, I guess, a package of charges, is a lot bigger than what had come out a few months ago. Can you explain the significance of these new charges from, you know, a criminal standpoint and I suppose from a timeline standpoint as well?
Well, it provides more pressure. It puts more pressure on both of those individuals that were already charged by the special counsel, Bob Mueller. So there was already, I believe, a 12-count indictment that was unveiled against both Paul Manafort, the former Trump campaign chairman, his associate, essentially the deputy campaign chairman during the Trump campaign, that's Rick Gates. This was a superseding indictment that unveiled new charges, leveled new charges against both of them, including not being truthful in their IRS filings, their federal income tax forms. These carry significant penalties, provides more pressure on Rick Gates and Paul Manafort to try to strike a plea deal. And in fact, that's what we saw on Friday on the part of Rick Gates. Rick Gates, perhaps the pressure just got too much for him. Perhaps his legal bills were getting so high. He did strike a deal of some sort. We don't know the contours of that with the special counsel and pleaded guilty in federal court.
We've talked about this quite a bit and rely on your expertise in this for a reason, because you were recently admitted to the D.C. bar. You had pointed something out to me and other reporters earlier this week about the significance of where this indictment was handed out from.
It was handed out from the Eastern District of Virginia. Why is that important? Well, the Eastern District of Virginia is the same district that Paul Manafort considers his residency. Why is that important? Well, if the Attorney General for the Commonwealth of Virginia wished to piggyback on these federal charges and charge Paul Manafort in particular with violating state law by filing an inaccurate state income tax form, that would be significant. Why? Because President Trump has the power of the pardon, but that power of the pardon only protects individuals or only absolves individuals from crimes that are federal. It does not absolve them from crimes that are state crimes. And that may provide, if the Attorney General of Virginia wishes to do so, that may provide more pressure on Paul Manafort, who may be counting on a pardon down the road from President Trump, to say essentially, hey, you may get that federal pardon, but it doesn't absolve you for these state crimes where you face a year in prison for each of those counts that the federal indictment brings against him.
Now is a good time to point out a couple of things. One, and you can probably help explain this better than I can, these crimes that are alleged in this indictment have absolutely nothing to do with either Rick Gates or Paul Manafort's work in the Trump campaign, correct?
That is correct. Nothing at all in terms of their work for the Trump campaign. All of the activities that they have been charged with are all activities that took place before, in some cases many years before, they joined the Donald Trump for President campaign.
So from the White House perspective, you know, if they're watching these indictments come forward, if they're looking at these guilty pleas, they're still safe in that default position, right? That there is no evidence, though, far that has been presented by Robert Mueller in any of the indictments, whether they be the ones from last year, whether they be the ones from last week with these Russian nationals, that show any sort of linkage between Russian officials, the Russian government, and the Trump campaign when it comes to this broader election meddling investigation.
That's right. You know, that we've heard the president say it time and time again, no collusion, no collusion. And that's the statement the president is sticking by. And as far as the various indictments and, in fact, plea deals that have been reached with the special counsel, Bob Mueller, there is no proof, no allegation of any type of collusion between the Trump campaign and any Russian official.
One more bit of news that was made late this week, and that is North Korea, a new package of sanctions targeting the North Korean regime, notably announced right about the time that the first daughter and senior advisor to the president, Ivanka Trump, landed for the closing ceremonies of these Winter Olympics.
Yeah, it's Ivanka Trump that's leading the delegation for the closing ceremonies in South Korea. And at the same time that Ivanka Trump was being welcomed with a dinner at South Korean President Moon's residence, these sanctions were announced against North Korea. And the White House says they're the toughest sanctions yet. The president was asked today, what happens next? What happens if there's no movement by North Korea in terms of trying to evade sanctions or trying to go about scaring the world with its nuclear weapons program? Well, the president said if the sanctions don't work, he said we'll go to phase two. And he said phase two may be a very rough thing. He called it very unfortunate for the world. So we do know the president has not taken military action off the table. Perhaps the president was alluding to that.
It was another busy week for you in the West Wing. I'm sure another busy week ahead. Have a good weekend, John.
Thanks a lot, Jared. You too.
President Trump spent part of his Friday at CPAC, the annual Conservative Political Action Conference held the last several years just outside of D.C.
We celebrate our history and our heroes, and we believe young Americans should be taught to love their country and to respect its traditions. Don't worry, you're getting the wall. Don't worry, okay? I heard some. Getting the wall.
President Trump returned to his campaign-style riff off script, taking on familiar targets like John McCain and Hillary Clinton. The crowd even chanted, "Lock her up and build the wall." The president read a poem titled "The Snake" that was a mainstay at his 2016 rallies, comparing the message he says to his immigration policies. CPAC also faces criticism from both inside and outside the conservative movement for who is and is not invited to speak. This year was no different. There's been a lot of debate on social media and cable news about the invitation extended to Marine Le Pen, the 28-year-old niece of Marine Le Pen, the leader of France's National Front Party. Here's a bit of the message she shared Thursday.
After 40 years of massive immigration, Islamic lobbies, and political correctness, France is in the process of passing from the eldest daughter of the Catholic Church to the litanies of Islam. And the terrorism is only the tip of the iceberg.
And then there was this from NRA spokeswoman Dana Lash.
Crying white mothers are ratings gold to you and many in the legacy media in the back.
So controversial comments happen at CPAC. There are also serious policy conversations and panels from conservatives new and old to the movement. Even President Trump hasn't always had the easiest relationship with CPAC. He did not attend in 2016 during his Republican primary campaign, but the past 2 years he's been welcomed like a conquering hero. Rachel Sutherland has been covering CPAC this week in Maryland. She spoke with Matt Schlapp. He's the chairman of the American Conservative Union, the organization behind CPAC, about the current state of the conservative movement.
Does CPAC still really represent all conservatives?
CPAC, absolutely. This is the hub of activity or the beehive for conservatives. But, you know, these terms mean a lot of different things. People say, well, CPAC is more Trump. Well, he is the president of the United States. He is the one who's pushing this very conservative agenda, where we've had more conservative victories politically and from a public policy perspective than we've had in over a decade. So this crowd is so supportive of him. Sometimes people say, well, it's more about being a nationalist. I think the people here are just patriotic and want to stand up for America, which is why they talk about the flag and why they talk about the pledge and the anthem, and why they talk about it's okay to have borders and it's okay to control your immigration system. I think these are patriotic conservatives that love America. See, they think America is unique and special, and without America, the globe would be a darker place. If someone else wants to say that's nationalism, I suppose that's fine, but it's nationalism in the sense that we still believe in these constitutional principles Family is the foundation of a strong society. The Constitution is this wonderful document that's unfortunately constantly under attack, and that government doesn't solve our problems. It's Americans out there in the economy that give us economic prosperity.
Is he the only president to come 2 years in a row? I've heard different things.
He's the only, he's the first president since Ronald Reagan to come back in his first year, right after the election. And now for him and Vice President Pence, it's the first time in history that the president and the vice president have come back 2 years in a row. And it's also unprecedented to have this many members of the cabinet. So, you know, we're going to invite him to come back again. We think this is resulting in great things for the country.
Is Mitt Romney coming?
I did not invite Mitt Romney. I don't have anything against Mitt Romney. I hear he's a perfectly nice fellow. I've met him before.
But he's running for a big seat.
He's running for a big seat. I just feel like he ought to apologize to the people in this room for that rather repugnant and obnoxious and judgmental speech he gave during a CPAC, not at CPAC, because we wouldn't let it be at CPAC a couple of years ago. I feel like he hasn't apologized. If he would do that, I think he might heal some of these rifts, because he accused Donald Trump of not having principles and not being a conservative, and he was flat out wrong.
Said he would be a danger to democracy or
That's
something,
right.
if I remember.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he has some explaining to do for a lot of conservatives.
Rachel also spoke with longtime CPAC attendee Curtis Ellis, who served on President Trump's transition team and is now a senior policy advisor at America First Policies, a political organization promoting much of President Trump's agenda.
What you're seeing also is which strain of conservatism and politics is on the ascent. President Trump came here last year. I remember years ago I was coming here talking about the things that President Trump talks about, getting trade deals that work for Americans rather than work for some theoretical global international order. And people were looking at me like, gee, that's interesting. Never heard of that before. Now, that type of Trump populism has taken over CPAC. That is now the mainstream of this convention. And it's been a very interesting evolution.
So this change in kind of the direction of the conservative party in America that we've seen for a few years now. I mean, you mentioned 2016 and the rise of President Trump, and he didn't attend that year. And I remember being there, and people were so divided on candidate Trump. Everyone I talked to seemed to have a different idea about whether or not he should be president. And then last year coming to CPAC, it was almost a pep rally atmosphere. Everybody was just excited to see him as President Trump. But does CPAC really represent all conservatives?
That's the interesting thing, is this is a dynamic movement. Conservatism and American right-wing politics is a changing, evolving, living entity. Unlike the left-wing Democratic politics, which is frozen in amber, they haven't had a new idea in seven decades, and their old formula aren't working anymore. The old incantations fail to evoke the gods that they worship. So, but unlike that, conservatism and CPAC, it's a dynamic, moving thing. A few years ago, like Rand Paul, libertarianism was in the ascent, and now we see Trump populism, blue-collar conservatism ascendant. Conservatism is not a monastic academic creed. It is a real-world religion. It's a real-world theory and practice that addresses the needs of the American people. And that's very exciting. And you do have different schools of thought and different attitudes. And there's not a College of Cardinals sitting in Washington, D.C. think tank telling everybody what we're all supposed to think and march in lockstep.
Remember those pictures made up of a bunch of dots, and if you stared long enough, you'd see a sailboat? I could never see the sailboat. But critics of Pennsylvania's congressional map say they see shapes, especially in a southeastern district sometimes called Goofy Kicking Donald Duck, because of the shape the outline of that district's boundaries form. The point is, congressional shapes can sometimes look, well, goofy. And another term you sometimes hear is gerrymandered. In Pennsylvania, the state Supreme Court says it can fix it, redrawing a map ahead of November's elections. But Republicans in Pennsylvania are suing, and analysts say the map likely will give Democrats a bit of an advantage. That's how Kyle Condick sees it, too. He's the managing editor for Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. If for no other reason than I like to say Goofy kicking Donald Duck, let's start with this map that was redrawn, this congressional map that was redrawn by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. By all accounts, this map, which Republicans are challenging, trying to get federal courts to step in, is going to help Democrats. You guys at the University of Virginia Center for Politics flipped some of these seat ratings, right?
Yeah, so the current Pennsylvania congressional map is drawn to elect 13 Republicans and only 5 Democrats in a state that was basically close to 50-50, in the 2016 election, and prior to that had a little bit of a Democratic lean. Part of the reason the Republicans were able to draw themselves such a good map in after the 2010 census was that Democrats are largely concentrated in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, basically, mostly the Philadelphia area. But certainly the map was sort of designed to, basically minimize the number of Democratic seats. So it was a pretty shrewd Republican gerrymander. What the court decision in Pennsylvania did was sort of unwind that map and draw a map that is closer to 50-50. And the court, I think, made some decisions that basically were favorable to Democrats, but I wouldn't necessarily call the map a Democratic gerrymander. And the result is going to be that the Democrats should easily pick up at least one seat and probably more than that. I think it's reasonable to think that the Democrats could get somewhere between 2 to 5 net seats out of Pennsylvania. Now, that was potentially possible on the old map, too, but it's easier under this one. And so, if the Democrats win the House by just a seat or two in November, it may be that the new Pennsylvania districts were the difference in deciding the majority. So this could be very important.
Let's talk about this idea of gerrymandering. As you said, Republicans were in control of the state house in Pennsylvania after the 2010 census. We're able to use that census data to draw these congressional maps. We joked about that 7th district, which people claim, I don't see it so much, claim that it looks like the character of Goofy kicking the character of Donald Duck. The point is, though, it is an oddly drawn district that wraps around and has these huge areas and then these very narrow areas and then another huge area. The map that was put out by the court doesn't have any of that. Everything's pretty symmetrical. But again, to your point, is the idea to create symmetry or is the idea to create a fair representation of that part of the state?
I think that what the court did was to make what is a fairer map than the one that Republicans drew, but also this new map, it makes some individual decisions that I think on balance are more favorable to Democrats than Republicans. Again, I don't think this is as dramatically, favorable of a map to Democrats as the old one was to Republicans. But again, there are just little decisions here and there that generally broke in the Democrats' favor. And interestingly, this map drawn by the court was actually more favorable to Democrats than the ones that Democrats themselves proposed, as the governor, who's a Democrat, and the state legislature, who are Republicans, released competing maps. So again, this decision definitely broke in a favorable way to Democrats. Also, the state Supreme Court in Pennsylvania is elected, and Democrats took control of it in 2015. And I doubt that a Republican elected court would have intervened in this case. And also, this case is based on state law, not federal law, so it doesn't really have any application to other states. However, the U.S. Supreme Court is currently considering a number of cases that may institute some sort of national standard for what is and what is not, so-called gerrymandering. The court has never really prohibited, gerrymandering in House districts before. Now, the court has weighed in before on racial redistricting, but not really on gerrymandering. In fact, for a lot of American history prior to the 1960s, U.S. congressional districts didn't even have to have equal population. And so the courts finally weighed in the 1960s and said, hey, wait a second, the state legislative districts and U.S. House districts have to at least be have equal population or roughly equal population. And so, you know, that was a congressional malapportionment, you know, districts that had a lot more people than other districts in the same state used to be a major problem in American politics. It isn't anymore. Some would argue that gerrymandering, you know, majority party, you know, drawing lines that benefits them against the other party. Some argue that that is also a pernicious problem. And it may be one that the Supreme Court decides to do something about, or maybe not. We'll just have to wait and see on that. But the bottom line takeaway from this new Pennsylvania map, assuming that it stands, is that Democrats have an easier time to gain seats in Pennsylvania than they did before.
Yeah, because you mentioned the court has weighed in on issues where it believed that the point of the map was drawn in a way to limit minority voting. But what it's a case out of Wisconsin, right, that the Supreme Court recently heard on whether or not there can be a political gerrymander. In other words, if you elect a Republican legislature or you elect a Democratic legislature, why don't they have the ability to favor their own party? Why is that wrong? Right. That's kind of what the Supreme Court's looking at right now.
Right. That is what the court is looking at. And they've also brought in some other cases from other states that they're going to, you know, they may issue some sort of sweeping ruling. But again, it's hard to determine what sort of standard the Supreme Court would set for gerrymandering. And again, gerrymandering, you know, the term dates back to the early days of the Republic. You know, a map was drawn in Massachusetts to advantage one party. The governor of Massachusetts at the time was Elbridge Gerry. The soft or the hard G became a soft G over time. And so that's the origin of the term gerrymandering. And you can see examples of gerrymandering throughout American history. And, you know, I do think that the way that a lot of states draw districts now is probably unfair. And I think that Republicans benefited from being able to gerrymander way more states after 2010 than the Democrats were able to do. But, you know, what you actually do about it from a legal standpoint, you know, I think is kind of tricky. So I'm curious to see what the court says.
That's quite the political legacy for the former governor of Massachusetts.
Yeah, but we butcher his name and the way we pronounce the terms. So it should really be gerrymandering.
Gerrymandering. But, so you mentioned that these redrawn maps, if they hold up through the November elections, could tilt the balance, especially if the race for the House is particularly close. Let's talk about these broader themes. Over the last several days, President Trump has been tweeting out his optimism about what national polling is saying. Republicans running much better in some of these opinion polls than they had been just a few months ago. You look at all of this polling. I know you're looking at a ton of House races. How do you see right now these trend lines?
I still think they're pretty good for Democrats. They have gotten better for Republicans. The president's approval rating was in the high 30s. It's now more like in the low 40s, which is better, but it's still pretty poor. And typically in the House generic ballot, the national polls that sort of measure, you know, which party the public prefers in House races, you know, the Democrats still have a lead of about 8 points on average in those polls, which is still pretty good. Now, you know, those polls can change. You know, if you were to have an election right now with these numbers, I think you'd probably think that the Democrats would have 50-50 or better odds to win the House. But of course, we're not having an election right now. We're having an election many months from now. Some of the kind of micro level indicators have been good for Democrats, too. Special elections in a lot of state legislative seats have generally shown a good Democratic performance, not always, but often.
I was going to ask about that because Democrats have performed very well in some of these special state house races. But, you know, those are a very small sample size, right? There are not a lot of people that show up in a state house special election to vote.
And they typically have pretty poor turnout. Now, granted, midterm turnout is usually only, you know, 35 to 40% anyway. But, you know, you have had Democrats perform well in some high turnout races, too. The Virginia governor's race is a good example. That was a high turnout race. And the other thing is that, you know, Republicans were the ones who generally performed well in sort of certainly in midterms and also these off year special elections during the Obama years. And so I think that at the very least, the special elections are indicators of increased Democratic enthusiasm. And Democrats also express more excitement about the midterms in national polling. And again, that was the Republicans doing that during the Obama years. And so, you know, there's sometimes an enthusiasm gap in off-year and midterm elections that breaks in favor of the non-presidential party.
You did, in this conversation, make a good point, and that's we look at these polling through the lens of what's called a generic ballot, essentially asking
right.
voters, would you rather vote for a Republican or would you rather vote for a Democrat? We do not know, in most of these cases, who the nominee in those races will be.
Right.
And as we saw just a few months ago in Alabama, who the nominee is will be very important.
Yeah, and there are huge primary fields in many congressional districts across the country, you know, particularly with there are lots of Democratic challengers. And, you know, sometimes the candidates who emerge from these primaries will be very strong. Other times it may be that candidates who have a harder time in the general election end up emerging from these primaries. You know, so that's something to watch, too. And then again, sort of more on the micro level, specific electoral rules in states matter as well. For instance, the Democrats probably need to win multiple new seats from California to win the House. California has an electoral system where everyone competes in the June primary, so everyone from all parties compete, and then the top two vote-getters advance to what is effectively a runoff in the general election. And there have been times when two members of the same party have advanced to the runoff, you know, particularly if you've got a, you know, 15 candidate field. And so maybe, you know, two Republicans get 15% apiece and three Democrats get 14% apiece. Then, you know, then obviously if you don't send a candidate to the general election, you can't win the seat. And I know Democrats are worried about that in some of the California districts. So again, the big picture indicators matter here, but also, you know, if you know, the Democrats don't send a candidate to the general election in one or more of these California seats, it could sort of, you know, slightly reduce their chances of winning the House. You know?
So it leaves us plenty to talk about between now and November. We'll probably do it again a few times between then and now as well, Kyle. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
In baseball, a tie goes to the runner. Some of these sports the past few days at the Olympics have been decided by hundredths of a second. There's photo finishes, slow-mo replays of aerial stunts. There's really not such a thing as instant replay at the Supreme Court. But next week, we will have something similar. The justices will hear a challenge to public sector union dues paid by non-members to cover the cost of benefits guaranteed in collective bargaining negotiations. If it sounds familiar, it should. Just 2 years ago, the exact same question was raised by a group of California school teachers who did not want to continue paying fees to a union they don't belong to. In that case, the justices were split 4-4, a tie, which in the world of the federal judiciary means the lower court ruling stands. It was a win for the union, a loss for the teachers. Well, here's the instant replay. The Supreme Court, made up of the same members plus Neil Gorsuch, will hear a different challenge, this one from Mark Janis, an Illinois Health and Family Services employee who is not a member of the Government Workers Union.
In the case of Mark Janis, he looks at what the union's doing, how they're speaking with his money, and saying that not only are they using my money, but I'm forced to associate with them in the sense that, you know, this notion that they're speaking for me when they're not.
Mark Mix is the president of the National Right to Work Foundation, the group taking on Janis's Supreme Court challenge. What he wants is the Supreme Court to overturn its own precedent set in a 1977 case that allowed public employees to be forced to pay union fees related to employment contract negotiations. Mix says it sets up a monopoly.
Frankly, it's a great business model. If I could force you to buy my product all the time as a condition of your livelihood, then I have no incentive to be out there advocating for things that are beneficial to my membership. I just have an obligation to get as many people into this compulsory collective as I can.
The union's argument is, if it's not broke, don't fix it. Illinois also makes a similar case. They argue upending decades-old precedent would undermine states' rights. After all, only 22 states allow these fair share fees. They're prohibited in part or entirely in 28 states. Now, if you follow the Supreme Court at all, you've heard the term swing justice, whose opinion a ruling could ultimately come down to in a 5-4 split. In this case, it's all about Justice Neil Gorsuch. During his confirmation, he tried to defend himself from critics who claimed he had an anti-union bias or an anti-worker bias.
If we're going to pick and choose cases out of 2,700, I can point you to so many in which I have found for the plaintiff in an employment action or affirmed a finding of an agency of some sort for a worker or otherwise.
He is the only justice on the bench who did not hear that California teachers challenge back in 2016. The justices who did hear it, who remain on the bench, were equally divided. If those positions don't change, then Gorsuch is the justice attorneys will need to convince. And this isn't the only First Amendment case being considered by the court, either. Do you own any candidate apparel, like a Make America Great Again ball cap or a Bernie or Bust t-shirt? Should you be allowed to wear those political messages while you vote? Vote. Minnesota says no. In a brief filed with the court, the state says its law is a century-old doctrine designed to protect Minnesotans' right without interference or distraction. After all, electioneering, actually campaigning, is often off-limits within a certain proximity of voting booths. A group of Minnesota voters, however, say this law is a clear free speech violation. The challenge starts with a man who was wearing a Tea Party logo t-shirt and a button that read, "Please ID me." He was told at the polling place to cover up those messages. In the challenge, the ban on political apparel is viewed as broad and potentially discriminating to some political ideologies. A sweeping ruling one way or another from the court could have big implications on how you decide to dress the next time you vote. That will do it for the From Washington podcast this week. President Trump has laid out some of his proposals to end gun violence at schools, but what Congress is willing to do will be critical in this ongoing national dialogue. Lawmakers do return next week. That will be our first sense of how quickly they're willing to move on some of these proposals. And if there's another effort to restart the immigration debate and find a solution for DACA recipients, those immigrants brought to the U.S. illegally as children, then Congress will need to move fast to meet a March 5th deadline. We'll keep track of all of it. Of course, a lot can happen between now and our next podcast. The best way to stay up to date is our Top of the Hour radio newscast. Listen to it right on your radio. There's also the Fox News Radio app. You can also listen on Amazon's Alexa, Apple Siri, and Google Play. Just ask for Fox News or your favorite Fox News radio podcast, like this one from Washington with a Fox News rundown. For all of us at Fox News Radio, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.